Hey guys, and welcome to the Three Drinks In podcast, episode number 139. I am your host, Vince. Phil's not with me for the intro, but he will be in the episode. In this show, we are talking about the new Star Trek Deep Space Nine documentary, What We Left Behind, available to you for one night only, just this past week as a Fathom event. So if you saw it, great. If you didn't, you'll have to look for the DVD coming out at some point. No guests because we couldn't find anybody to talk about the show, but you should definitely send us your thoughts and comments if you did manage to get to this Fathom event. Before we get into the show, I want to remind you that we are available on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn, also Overcast and Radio Public. Just search for Three Drinks In Podcast. You'll easily find us. Click subscribe, tell your friends, and leave a review. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at @ThreeDrinksInPod. Like us on Facebook and email us at ThreeDrinksInPodcast@gmail.com. All right, that's everything. Here we go.
I want you to try something for me. Take a sip of this.
What is it?
A human drink. It's called root beer.
I don't know.
Come on. Aren't you just a little bit curious? What do you think?
It's vile.
I know. It's so bubbly and cloying and happy.
Just like the Federation.
But you know what's really frightening? If you drink enough of it, you begin to like it.
It's insidious.
Just like the Federation.
Do you think they'll be able to save us?
I hope so.
Okay.
I'm trying to think of ways to start talking. It felt odd to have a guest for this episode because it was like, who are we going to invite? The guys who made the show about the show that they already made?
Okay. Avery Brooks.
Yeah, that should be it. Avery Brooks is our guest tonight, everybody. We got world-renowned stage and screen actor Avery Brooks.
I'd invite him, but he scares me.
Oh, he's terrifying. My favorite story from when we went to go see Armin Shimerman and Ethan Phillips at the podcast that was recorded live at the Star Trek convention was they're trying to describe what it was like on set of DS9 versus on Voyager. And Armin turns to Ethan Phillips and says, what did you call the woman who played the captain on your show? He's like, I don't know, Catherine or... Katie, I think this is what they called her. And it's like, yeah, we called him Mr. Brooks.
Yeah.
And like, oh, it's amazing that he just took himself so seriously. And like Patrick Stewart had a thing about that, like the first season of the show, he was this stodgy British guy that didn't know how to lighten up and the rest of the cast was so goofy. Mm-hmm. And he said like after a year, I just said, fuck it. And just kind of went for it. And everyone got along much better after that.
Well, yeah. I mean, they helped lighten him up a little bit.
Yeah.
A very self-serious kind of person. But Avery Brooks is, you know, he's angry. He's an angry person.
He seems to be, yeah.
And that's a different kind of, like, you know, you're not stuck up when you feel slighted by everybody.
Yeah.
It's his worldview. You know, it is what it is.
Yeah. So. Very, very particular about, I mean, I in the few bits of... documentary footage that they had of him from previous interviews, he always used the word brown to describe himself and not black.
Yeah, he says brown people.
I thought that was interesting, which, if you think about it, is actually more accurate. There are very few people whose skin is so dark that it could really be called black.
Mm.
You know, but yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. You're a weird guy, Ace.
Yeah. Any more like gum?
So
okay.
So we finally saw this documentary that's been in the works now for, God, for how long?
5 or 6 years, something like that.
It was 2015, they said. In the post-film roundtable discussion. I think it was at least 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there was rumblings of this, and then rumblings of like, okay, they're gonna do the same thing they did for Next Generation with the, you know, with the HD scanning and what have you. Then that never happened, and then this kind of came and went, and no one really knew what was going on. And then all of a sudden, like, you know, it just showed, like, did you find it or did I find it? Like, they're doing a one night only Fathom event, and that's it.
Yeah, I followed them on Twitter. Oh, okay. So they were, and like, I happened to just be scrolling when they said, like, we're doing this in a couple months. We're having a Fathom event, and the DVD will come out eventually, but we're going to, you know, stream it on the movies. And I was like, okay, well, let's do that. And we finally got to see it.
Yeah. So what did you think of what we left behind?
It was okay. you know, you're making a documentary. You kind of want to hit all the main points of something. And when you do it 20 years after the fact for a TV show, I mean, nothing's changed. It's not like you have years and years and years of stuff to talk about. You had 7 years of people working on a TV show. And I kind of thought they would look back at the legacy of the show a little bit more. Whereas in this one, they spent a lot of time sort of rehashing things that had already been talked about in the various interviews and AMAs on Reddit and things like that. And they kind of just hit all the bigger ones. And they even kind of mentioned at the end during the credits, like, well, we didn't get to this, but we had to make room for something. And I was like, that's true, but, you know, what's the impact that the show's now had today? I mean, people still watch it. It's big on Netflix, and we went to the convention, and we saw young people there who knew, dressed in character.
Still blows me away.
Right. I mean, you can talk about that. You can talk about, I mean, so many things that it had an impact on. You know, yes, serialized storytelling, absolutely, but I found it interesting that they had all these kids in this documentary that they were interviewing.
We're cute.
You know, 10-year-olds, like, who's your favorite character? And it's like, oh, it's Kira Nerys because she's a badass and this and that. And I'm like, yeah, Star Trek's always had women characters who are, you know, important and role models. And, you know, they've, as Avery Brooks would say, brown people, and people found that inspiring. So I thought there'd be a little bit more about that. You know, what people took from the show today, you know, how do the writers contribute to their storytelling? And Ron Moore rebooted Battlestar Galactica, and it was a big, big deal. You watched it, right?
I want to say there was 4 seasons. I got through like just the beginning of season 3, maybe like halfway through. And then I stopped for some reason and I couldn't get back into it. And I remember hearing later on that like they ended up not having a real plan for where the show was going. And it was before you could do like kind of like, you know, not short form TV, but like abbreviated TV, unopen ended television. And right. So they were kind of writing themselves out of a corner they'd written themselves into when, like, you know, because the title card for every episode of that show was like, this, you know, the Cylons are back and they have a plan. And it turns out nobody had a plan.
Yeah.
And I didn't actually, I was like, oh, well, okay. And then I never just got back into it. It was just kind of going, like, I wasn't sure where it was going. And then when someone said it wasn't going anywhere, I went, oh, well, then I'm less invested in doing this.
Well, he started on DS9. So, like,
it was started on Next Gen.
Right.
But yeah, then, all the big Klingon episodes for Next Gen.
Yeah. It would have been interesting to see how he took that approach from one show to the other, and then what he's doing now. I don't know what he's doing now, but so they didn't have too much of that, which I thought was kind of a bummer.
Outlander now.
Oh, okay.
It's a sexy time traveling show about Scottish people, and the ladies love it.
Mm.
It's about kilts and softcore pornography.
Yeah.
Yes, haggis is softcore pornography.
What did you think about it?
I thought it was a pretty poor documentary, as documentaries go. I enjoyed listening to people who were involved with the show talk about the show, because I like talking about this show and I can talk about it all day long. I remember, like, I was constantly talking to you during it. Go, oh yeah, that part was great, or this was funny, or, I mean, I almost fell out of my chair when Rene Aubergenois pointed out the fact that Terry Farrell couldn't act away out of a plastic bag when the show started, and I was like, you know, we've all thought that. My God, it wasn't just us, you know. But it didn't have a point of view. Like, I think the first hurdle that they had to deal with, which was essentially they did this to themselves, was that they made a documentary about themselves. So once you do that, you're sort of you're not going to know how to focus things, because you have so limited time, or there's such limited time, which is different than, say, like writing a memoir, because you know you've got a couple hundred pages to say, I'm going to write about this part of my life. Like the guy that got Running with Scissors, that memoir about the kid growing up with the crazy psychiatrist's family. He wrote like four other memoirs after that one, which was his big breakout hit. And they just all dealt with different aspects of his life. So one was about his childhood, one was about his drinking and getting sober, one was about the relationships he had with his mother and his father each. So, like, you know, you can sort of hyper-focus in a book about something and you're not really, you know, going to ignore too much, and if you do, you can always write more books. This seemed like they had to get everything in all at once, and they were going to leave a lot out, and I think that's just because they didn't know where to focus. And so it felt like there was stuff missing because there was no real point of view for the story. It was just like, we made the show a while ago, and there were some good things about it and some things that were groundbreaking and, you know, giving ourselves pats on the back for this, that, and the other thing. But it just didn't have a coherent point of view. It made the narrative sort of murky. Fun. But I looked at my watch a couple of times going, oh, it's only been an hour. Oh, this is another hour of this. Okay, this is fun, but, like, you know, only in, like, nuggets is it fun. You know, like, you know, I didn't know where they were going with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't watched too many documentaries. But, you know, I have watched a few about Star Trek, though. I mean, generally, you know, they're told from the point of view of moderate outsiders, like Trekkies, which was made by, what's her place, girl play Tasha Yar, did that one. So she had sort of like a half a foot in the door kind of thing.
I mean, well, that ties into my point in that they didn't focus on what I wanted. It wasn't about what I thought it was going to be about.
You know,
I thought it was going to be about looking back on how this show changed Star Trek, because it did, and helped change television in small ways, which it did. I mean, they gave themselves the credit for that. And you're right, it turned out not to be about any of that. It was a lot of a rehash. And I've been following this documentary being made, you know, now for years, where they're, oh, we'd love to do a DS9 documentary. And I was like, wow, that'd be great. And then, oh, we've getting all these interviews, and we're going to remaster some of the show for HD. And when I think back on it now, it was only a few days ago, I remember being very disappointed that there weren't many interviews, or they weren't very long. Like, I don't think Robert O'Reilly said one word. He was just on the screen for a moment.
Yeah, that was an odd thing. Like, he was on the screen for a half a second. He played a pretty big role as a guest star on that show. He was on it a lot. And they even had a little joke on, like, in the little thing under his, where his name popped up, and it just said Silent Bob O'Reilly. I'm like, I guess because, like, Silent Bob is the joke from, what's it called? Clerks. And he didn't actually say anything in the course of the documentary. So in post, they just made a crack out of that. But yeah, I wanted to hear more from Bob, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, I don't see what the point of going to such great expense and time and asking these people questions if you're not going to show them. The only one I thought was interesting was Rick Berman, because it's clear that Rick Berman and Ira Stephen Bear don't get along.
Yeah.
You know, and Rick Berman, unfortunately, now has the reputation of hating Star Trek, but also stopping Deep Space Nine from achieving more than what it wanted to do. Like he's looked on as the villain of that show. So like if he was going to have a point or a point of view, it would be how Ira Stephen Bear fought Rick Berman every step of the way and won most battles. And I get the sense they didn't want to do that to him, you know?
You know, I think, I mean, we just read, was it like a year ago, that enormous two-part oral history of the franchise came out?
Yes, I have actually reread that.
Yeah, like, I think I might go take a look at that again because I really enjoyed, like, not so
it's
much...
Very good.
Not so much the first half. Like, they had one whole book on the original series. I'm thinking to myself, that's too much time for one. I mean, the show was only on for 65 or so episodes.
Well, what made that one good was that they, after they get through the show, and then they spend like half that book, so I guess a quarter of the whole thing, when it's the show's off the air. Like, what was going on in the country and in pop culture at the time that kept it going? Which that was much bit more interesting.
Oh, maybe I'll go back and read that because I didn't have the patience for it.
Because they said, like, there is no Star Trek. It's not on. And hasn't been for, like, a decade. Yet these nutcases are still sitting outside the comic book store. So that part was okay.
Get a life.
Yeah. What's the matter with you people? I mean, it was just a show.
Yeah. But
the thing with those books is that, and I understand this complaint, that those books were written mostly from the perspective of the writers.
Yeah.
And so the actors were interviewed, but not as much. So I thought even more there'd be interviews in this documentary from the actors. And, not really. No.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of bullshit.
Yeah. Well, there was a lot of that.
A
lot of cheesy gags.
Cheesy gags. A lot of Ira Stephen Bear talking. And I mean, he's not that... I mean, he says it himself, and he's right. He's not a gifted interviewer. It is a skill, and you know, you either have that or you don't. That's a pretty difficult thing to kind of walk into and do. Is take people who worked for you for years and have them tell stories about you, and you know, hopefully you want to hear how great you were. But yeah, he did not do a great job of pulling out of them anything really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
That's lost my train of thought entirely. But, the gag. But, yeah, so, like, the songs were weird. I don't know why they were singing. I don't know. Max Grodinchek had to sing a song. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, yeah. So, like, he's... The thing that kind of... nags at me the most, though, and I don't know, this is something I keep hearing when people talk about Star Trek, certainly when like LeVar Burton talks about it, or Avery Brooks, or Whoopi Goldberg, or you know, any of the female characters, is like they talk about the gender stuff and the race stuff, and that's just something that maybe we were young when we watched this, we were kids. But it sort of didn't make an impression on me, which is sort of, I think, the point. When, like, I don't notice that all three actors in the frame in this scene are black. Or when Kira is a really tough character, but she's a woman. Like, none of these things had any impact on me whatsoever. Like, I could... there were things... that were obvious when certain gender roles were sort of not addressed on Star Trek. There were women admirals, there were women captains, there was nobody who wasn't, there were women security officers. You know, there was no discussion of, you know, certain things can't be done because they're a woman, or you know, that the whole modern sense of gender and race relations just didn't matter. It wasn't brought up. I think it was mentioned in one episode of TNG where you have the androgynous race and Riker is trying to describe the differences between men and women to that person, And he's saying how men are built differently, and women will wear makeup, and men can grow beards, etc. But for all of them, that's kind of what they all wanted to talk about at some point. And that just bores me, because it's
you're a white hetero cis male.
Well, yes.
That's what they would say to you.
Yeah, but like, I don't know. I can't tell if this is just a sign of the times, and the way that we talk about this now is to be hyper aware of it, rather than what they would have done maybe 50 years ago, which was just being unaware of it was sort of more the goal. Like, you didn't, I have a friend who happens to be gay, who happens to be black. It's just sort of incidental to the person underneath the surface. Whereas now we have to constantly point out when somebody's this and that it's good. And part of that's my point of view. I realize that, like, I'm sure that when my daughter grows up, she's going to look at characters in pop culture and like them because they're female and because she can identify with them. And they are a minority in certain franchises and such. But it just sort of, it never stood out to me. And so I was really bothered when they were talking about the episode of DS9. Was it Past Lives? Something like that. The one where Dax meets the person that she was married to when the two of them had different bodies.
Right, and now they're both women.
Right, and so like it was one of those really subtle Star Trek-y double entendre type things where, like, in the show, the point, the story was that these two characters are Trills, and Trills, they happen to, possess symbionts that were in previous hosts that happened to be married to each other. One was male, one was female. Both of them have died. Those hosts died, and the symbiont moves on into these two new hosts who are both the same gender. And the taboo in the show is that you're not supposed to meet up and spend time and rekindle old relationships with, the new hosts of old symbionts, because you want the symbiont to experience as many different kinds of people and to have varied experiences, not for two people to live together forever in just different bodies. And that actually makes a lot of sense. It is a compelling cultural perspective for a fake culture that doesn't exist. I think that that's a really interesting way to go about doing this. Because it's true. Like, if the whole point of having these things is to give them knowledge that can be passed on for generations, then yeah, you wouldn't want to have two folks who just decided that they love each other so much that, no matter what happens to us, we're going to make sure that we're together no matter what bodies we're in. That's an interesting science fiction concept. But they used that to tell the other, kind of story, which was these were two women who were in love with each other, and that's not weird. That's okay, too. It's a different kind of taboo, but it shouldn't be. And I was always impressed by that, and I was proud of Star Trek for doing that and telling that story in an interesting way and not shoving it down the throat of the audience to say, you people who look at this and are offended by it are wrong and you should be ashamed of yourselves. They did it in a much more, sort of graceful way, and they still got shit for it. People still complained and wanted there to be a warning put before the episode, and but they don't give that to themselves. He even says, like, we don't deserve the pat on the back for that episode because we didn't go far enough by saying that Garak was gay.
Yeah.
And I sat there and all I could think of was J.K. Rowling in that whole, like, oh, by the way, Dumbledore, he was gay too. If it's not in the show, then it's not in the show. You don't get to retcon that later on just so you could feel more woke today. And I think that they do themselves a disservice, and it's embarrassing for them to kind of want to give themselves that pat on the back 20 years later by admitting, we were wrong to not tell everyone he was gay. It didn't matter that he was gay. And in fact, Andrew Robinson has said in interviews that he wanted him to be sort of pansexual because that would be beneficial to him as a spy. And I thought that that was a really interesting way to look at it. And in that show, the Americans that I watched last year, that was one of the really sort of disturbing things about the spy characters in that show, was that every now and again there'd be a flashback. The two main characters we'll be talking about, we'll be talking about their training for the mission. And one of the trainings was to teach them how to be able to perform sexually with anybody at all, because you never knew who you're going to have to seduce to get information. And there's this really weird scene with the guy who's being, you know, this is kind of told in the oddly filmed flashback sequence of having to interact with old women and men and all kinds of stuff. And that, you know, so that reminded me of what Andrew Robinson had said about. And so it's not that Garrick is gay. It's that Garrick is who he needs to be to accomplish missions and to get information he needs. And so just to say, well, he was gay, and we should have been, you know, more upfront about that. It's like, well, it's not important to what's going on. It's not interesting.
I think what it is so you, I mean, you and I were raised this way, and I think it's the right way to go. And I think Star Trek sort of agreed at the time, because, you know, older Star Trek was in the 80s and 90s, is that there are differences between people, and yet they should be afforded the same opportunities that anyone else can have. And in 99% of the time, they're just as capable of doing the same things that others can do. And science fiction is good for that, because they can do it with, you know, different aliens or holograms or whatever. You know, I have my rights and opportunities, and now this individual also deserves theirs. And so when Voyager came out, that's the first time I was really like aware of this sort of thing, that it was a big deal. They were going to make the captain a woman, you know, we're going on and on about things. She now, instead of three or four men, it's a woman. And when you watch that show, she's a woman, obviously, you know, and they didn't shy away from that she had a fiance and she wanted to have kids someday. And, you know, she had a maternal instinct to her. And yet she was just as capable as any of the other men running the ship. She was tough. She could be mean if she had to. She was determined. You know, she was the captain.
She was very physically fit, too. There was lots of scenes of her sweating and running around in tank tops.
She could hold a gun. Like, it never came up ever, at least by all the Federation people, you know, the people who were under her command, that she was a woman. It was all about, was she smart enough? Was she arrogant enough sometimes? You know, she looked down on the holograms and whatever. And so when I was watching the show, the novelty of her being a woman wore off instantly. Like, after that first episode, you're like, okay, she's the captain, whatever.
Yeah, she brings it up once in like this really cute scene with Harry Kim, where he calls her sir. And she says, I know that the regulations say that sir is acceptable for a man or a woman, but I don't like it. So, right. you can call me...
I think you call her ma'am.
He called her ma'am, and then she corrected him. Just call me captain, and ma'am will do when it's crunch time. And then he calls it her that right away. He goes, I'll let you know when it's crunch time. And I thought that was really cute. It was just a really cute way to address, like, how do we deal? Because ma'am sounds kind of...
Right, and that's one of those things where it's like...
Pedantic.
Like, we didn't have a word for this, and now we do. And there's a difference, and that's fine, but she's just as capable. You know, it's not her sex that's a detriment or advantage. And, you know, so to us looking at it that way, I just don't think that way. And so for us, it's like, I've never had to hope to see someone like me, because there are a lot of white men on these shows.
Yeah, we're not starved for it.
Right. But when I see other people, I don't feel bad about it either, because Star Trek never depicts them that way. They're all individuals, or they're part of a race. They're all humans and what have you. So unfortunately, in the last decade or two, we've gotten away from that in our culture and to our detriment. So I think to look back on it 20 years ago and be like, you know, we didn't do enough for gay rights in Star Trek. Well, at the time, they did a lot.
Yeah, and that's sort of what's kind of, because that's just nagging me. They did so much.
Like, don't feel bad.
And it doesn't all have to come at once. Like, I'm watching Friends right now with my wife as just like a placeholder for if we need something to watch on TV and we don't want to watch anything too heavy. And Friends actually doesn't hold up that well in light of these things. There's all kinds of, especially things about homosexuality on Friends that, like, yeah, there were jokes about it then too. Like, I don't know if the word gaydar showed up after Friends, but in one of the first season episodes, they all think Chandler's work friends all think he's gay, and he's not offended by it, but he's definitely put off. And he's like, what am I doing to give this vibe? And he talks to a guy in his office who is gay, and he's not picking up on the vibe from him. And so he's like, you know, my people have kind of a radar. And then that's the kind of, and then maybe from there, the term gaydar was coined. I'm not really sure. But like, that's a problematic thing these days. Like, just the way it's certain things are handled. It's not a thing that I can, like, that's one that sticks out in my head. And there are others, but they seem foreign. They date the show tremendously now.
Yeah, I think it's funny when you always hear people complain or raise objections to things like Gone with the Wind or Mark Twain. They're using the N-word all the time. And they're like, well, it was a different time. And then people on the other side will be like, but we should be aware of what it's changed. And the last time I saw it on some video on YouTube where they were saying, like, has anybody gone back and watched the original Spider-Man that same Sam Raimi did? There's a joke in there that just falls so flat now when he goes into the wrestling ring and he jumps up on top of the cage so he doesn't get like mangled, and the guy at the bottom of the cage starts growling at him, and Tobey Maguire goes, that's a nice unitard. Did your husband make it for you? And he gets like even more upset. And I'm sitting here going, I'm not laughing at that. But when it came out in 2000, I'm sure I laughed at that.
Yeah.
Everybody did. That was the joke.
Yeah.
And like, I'm not that old, but also a lot has changed in 20 years. So like, you know, sometimes those things, they were just a product of their time. And this is not, you know, nobody in blackface for God's sakes, but, you know, gay jokes were a thing.
Yeah. And it's also, it can be instructive to look at these things. I mean, sometimes it's like, it's not always easy. Like Gone with the Wind does get a little bit harder to watch every year because it's just, it's really awkward at certain points because they're so sympathetic in certain cases to their main characters who are all.
Well, I think the farther in time you go, I mean,
yeah,
you know, in 40 years, what'll that Spider-Man joke look like?
But it's also important, I think, to look at these things in terms of, well, how is this different from what came just before that? Like, I would say that the next big thing, or the previous big thing before Friends was Seinfeld, but they kind of ran side by side. But Cheers would be the biggest thing in between like the 70s and Friends. And there was no talk about this at all. Cheers was a very sort of blue collar kind of show. Your main buffoons were all the sort of effete people like Fraser Crane and the guy that ran the restaurant upstairs of Cheers. And, you know, the working man's bar was essentially what this was being sold as. And I didn't watch the show that much. There was probably a gay guy in that somewhere, but it didn't stand out. But, you know, Friends really did try to sort of push boundaries when it came to talking about, you know, people who were gay. And, you know, Ross's ex-wife in the first episode, you find out that she's gay.
Right.
You know, and they're, you know, these two women living with the, you know, the one night stand love child of, I don't know if, I forget how, but like they're raising Ross's kid kind of a thing. And it's, they're acknowledging that it's weird, but that it shouldn't be anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of like, we are taking steps to make sure that, you know, we are inclusive and respectful of everybody. And like they did it kind of obviously, but they still threw in a gay joke every now and again. You can still see the progress is my point. And the same thing is true of DS9. There was progress being made to draw attention to this. Whereas, you know, Star Trek the original series did it, but in a kind of like, look, a black guy, look, a lady, like that was as far as they went, except for those sort of goofy episodes with the half, you know, the half white face, half black face kind of guy. It was much more subtle in DS9. It was handled much more interestingly.
Well, the writing was better. I mean, yeah. And in interviews, they would always say, you know, we never sat at the table and threw up, you know, cultural issues and said, let's make an episode about it, because it doesn't work that way. It was, what can we do to the characters? And then like the cultural stuff comes in later. So it's like, let's explore two people who used to be lovers and now they've reconnected. Well, how can we make it like a twist on that? Like, oh, what if one was a woman now? And things like that.
Yeah.
I remember there was a Next Generation where they had the same concept, the Trills, where Dr. Crusher falls in love with the man. And when they have to switch the thing out of him, they put it into Riker for a little while. And she, you know, it was like, can you love someone who's changed so much? And then the writer said, like, well, how, you know, we had an episode where they put it back in a man. And by then, it, like, it wasn't really working. And they're like, well, how can we mess with it more? And then they put it in a woman. Hmm. And the doctor was like, I can't love you. And she says, like, maybe someday we'll be past this sort of thing. But right now we're not. And I can't love you because you're a woman.
That's true. I forget. Does that female character come back and say, like, this shouldn't be a problem for you?
Yeah, she says, like, I don't understand. I'm still the same person. And the doctor says, like, yeah, that's true, your personality-wise. But, like, physically, I don't find you attractive whatsoever anymore.
Wow. I forgot about it. I remember that episode. I remember it was like the big part of it was that she falls in love with a guy. And they hadn't quite worked out the concept of the Trill yet. So
it was completely changed.
Well, not completely, but like, you know, the symbiont in DS9 basically informed on a pre-existing personality. So there was a Jadzia, and then when she got the symbiont, she became Jadzia Dax, and she was an amalgamation of all the different people that had hosted the symbiont before. In the TNG episode, the symbiont was the brain, and it basically took over the body. And so when it was put into Riker, for some reason that worked, you know, physiologically.
Thing. We can bounce it around as much as we need to.
And, yeah, and it just, Riker became the other guy, and he had to do the episode as playing a different character, which is interesting as a one-off, but you can't do that, like, long-term. It, you know, they made them far more interesting later on with Dax and all them. But right there within the same exact characters, or they have a progression of, you know, cultural norms, and, you know, that's hysterical. I forgot all about that. They made progress and they didn't even realize it.
Right. It just came out of the story, really. What did you think of the writers in the room coming up with another episode on the fly?
That was actually my favorite part of the.
Yeah, I like that too.
Because you got to see that process, which I think you and I, you know, if we lived different lives, that's something that we would have been really interested to do.
It looked like so much fun. Yeah. I would have loved to do that. I mean, I know most people wouldn't, because it's difficult, time consuming, you know, egos get bruised. But just five guys sitting in a room trying to come up with the best ideas for a story. I was like, holy shit. How do you do this for a living?
A lot of dry erase boards and coffee and, you know,
yeah,
late night pizza. And like, yeah, that would have been great. But yeah, that to me was the most interesting part in having them bounce around. And I actually thought that the idea they came up with was, you know, it was pretty slapdash, because, you know, I imagine that once you work with people for a while, you get into a pattern where you can more easily complete thoughts, and, you know, your, you know, ideas run together more organically. But I did like the idea that, because, all right, so for those of you who didn't see the documentary, they got together a bunch of the old big writers to write what would be the opening of the eighth season of DS9, were it to be put back on the air now, with time having passed, and DS9 becomes a shrine. It becomes like a religious temple, and Kira leaves the military to become a Vedic, to, like, you know, oversee what's becoming like a cult of Sisko.
Yeah, that was interesting.
And like, I would never have gone that way, but that's actually really was good, because it basically reminded you that like this was like the religion was a huge part of this show, and you can't just like now everything is more military and action based with the Discovery, but like that was a huge component of this, and so that they led with that, I thought was interesting. I didn't know where they were going with it, where it was like, well, now she, you know, like the Jem'Hadar now work for her. I went, wait, what?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, it's been really 20 years since they did an episode, so they were kind of like, well, I mean, that's a process that takes a long time. And the guy said it in the clip. He was like, at this point, we would all go back to our rooms and start typing, and we would have really figured this out and probably come up with 10 different ways to do it or episodes in the meantime, and we would have finished it Monday. And, you know, but they're like, yeah, it's pretty good for what we got so far. You know, like, how do we get everybody back into one spot?
Yeah.
Because what they wanted to do at the end was separate everybody, which I always felt was strange, but makes sense.
Yeah, I liked that a lot, because there was really, I mean, that's what happens, you know, especially in this sort of, you know, itinerant lifestyle, which is how people tended to live on Star Trek, is like they really wouldn't be somewhere for too long. You wouldn't get too. It's a military show after all, so people would kind of move around and bounce and do this and that and everything. But so like it also sort of didn't allow people to come in and start screwing with the show once they were done. They kind of said, we're going to kill you, you're going to do this, you're going to go there, and like, if you want to get them back, you have to work at it. You can't just like, we are doing things with these characters because they're ours now. And this is what happens to the, you know, to the entire Klingon Empire. And this is what happens to these people. And, you know, the Breen are now half gone or whatever else it is. And Cardassia's been destroyed. Like, this, they were very permanent about certain things, which was good. Making decisions is an important step in telling stories. And they really made decisions about things. Except about Sisko, which is pretty vague, but what do you do with him when the whole thing is over? Nothing. You can't do anything with him. That's all they could do, is be vague about it and weird.
Yeah.
You know, that was the one open-ended thing, but like, it was such a strange situation they found themselves in. He was fighting the, you know, the evil god and Dukat and everything.
Yeah, if I'm being honest, the religion never really worked for me.
I liked it. I think they tried to tie it to everything else too much. I felt forced that at the last few episodes you had all these different storylines happening simultaneously, and the Dukat and Kai Winn was like the weakest of those threads. And they were trying to say that like this is all part of the plan, and if, you know, you can win the war, but then you have to go deal with this whole thing. And
well, it was always interesting that you had these people in the future that were still extremely religious, and to everybody else, like, you know, the viewer and whatever, you're trying to explain it through science, and they would say they're not really gods or prophets, they're aliens. And they have powers beyond us because they're extra dimensional beings and, you know, all that stuff. And then you're right, like the farther the show went, they started tying prophecies into it and destiny, and like the science aspect became less and less, and it just literally became magic and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like they stopped trying to explain things, and I was like, you're losing me.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't like that as much.
Yeah, they just kind of needed, they wanted to set up a way for Dukat to be involved with it somehow, I think, because he was such a great villain, and it was boring to have him just be the leader of the Cardassian people, and it was more interesting to watch him kind of fall and become something else. And then that's why, like, I didn't mind that there wasn't like a long protracted fight between him and Sisko. They just kind of killed themselves by jumping off that cliff.
Right. The hero sacrifices himself. The only way to stop the evil is to sacrifice yourself, yeah. which was fine.
Yeah. But, I don't know.
It's a shame that they can't get that remastered all on HD.
Yeah, that was interesting hearing them talk for a little bit about
the process and why it's, I didn't know why it's so expensive. And I thought it was just like, well, you know, the machines and the, you know, you have to scan, you know, scan all the stuff. It's like, no, you have to find it all. Basically, you're just taking the negative from the original show, which was scattered about in a salt mine somewhere on the on the East Coast, like away from light and moisture. I don't know, but like they're buried underground,
some sort of bunker.
And
not labeled like this, like the key grip just jammed the film into some bag and mailed it.
They were saying like, well, once we found what we need, was something it wouldn't be in the right place. I'm like, oh my god,
yeah,
how tedious a thing is this? So,
but, well, the reasoning has always been that they did it for the Next Generation, and they put it out on Blu-ray, and it didn't make enough money to recoup the cost. Like, it just wasn't worth it.
Mm.
And that's, I mean, at that point, people stopped buying DVDs like that.
Yeah, I think that's really what the wall they hit is, like the technology changed, and now we're streaming everything. And so you can stream TNG in that high def, but
like if they'd just done it earlier, I mean, I'm sure the technology wasn't there yet, but if it had happened when people were still buying the DVDs, probably would have made their money back. And Star Trek DVDs have always been crazy expensive.
Yeah.
Because you've got such a loyal fan base that will pay anything. I mean, I bought several seasons of Star Trek used because they were just way too much money. And even buying them used, I was still paying more than, I look back at it, more than I probably should have. You know, like what you would pay for a normal DVD. But like the boxes were ripped and the CDs weren't in great condition. And I was like, what's the only way to get them?
Yeah, back then that
was
it.
6 months later, they were streaming.
I mean, this show is why I got Netflix. Like back when Netflix was primarily a DVD mail service, it was like, oh my God, they have Star Trek. And every week I would get like two of them in the mail. And I was like, this is the greatest day ever. And I would sit there and I'd be so pissed if like disc four didn't work right, and I couldn't just go watch just disc five. I had to go, you know,
out of order.
So
I used to tape them on VHS when I was in college.
God. So anyway,
so have we exhausted this topic? I think they have.
I think there's more to say, but I think it's really only in terms of, I would like to have gotten a different person's perspective on the people who made it. Mm-hmm. Someone like us to kind of go in there and say, like, we're fans of this show, but we have nothing to do with it. We just watched it. And, you know, these are the questions that I have, because they're invariably going to be different than the questions that they're going to have for each other. And you also have to make sure that it's not a fanboy doing it, too.
Well, I was just about to say, and I don't mean to give ourselves tons of credit to put down anybody else, because I'm any other Yahoo who comments on everything he sees. But like, even when we were sitting at the theater and people were walking in, man, were they nerdy. Ugh. And so when they were interviewing people for the documentary up on screen, not all of them, but a lot of them were the same way, you know, in costume, with the production numbers memorized, you know, what would your character say if he ever was met this other character? It's like, well, that's not what I want to listen to or hear. Yeah. Otherwise, I'll just go watch the show. Yeah.
That's just about the worst thing. And somebody asked that question at the podcast we went to at the convention, was what would,
right, that's why I brought it up.
Yeah, Quark and Neelix were like, what would they say to each other? And like the two of them were like, it was obvious. Like Quark would take him for every penny he had. Like it's, but this is not interesting. There's a way to be a fan, and then there's a way just to drown in it. And even like Matt Myra from the Nerdist podcast, and you know, later of G4 and all these other, you know, weird channels that no longer exist. I remember watching a thing on YouTube of him interviewing Frakes and Burton about, and like he made them do like a fake kind of like jostle if the ship was being hit by like a photon torpedo, and like, you're in a position to, you know, yeah, it's a nerdy TV show, you know, you're asking questions of, you know, aging sci-fi actors. But, like, ask him real questions. Like, there's these people are real working actors. Like, there's a lot more that's interesting here to be mined than, you know, what one character would have said to the other character in my hypothetical scenario I just gave you 4 seconds ago. I mean, it's just stupid.
Well, maybe you know, maybe there isn't any more, and so that's why the people are ravenous for more. Like, here's the scenario that only exists in my head. I'm going to ask him about it.
Yeah, but
and
then
I'll,
there
and
was,
I'll get my fix.
But then there was the guy at the same podcast at the convention who asked my question, and I thought I was going to fall out of my chair. I was all set to get up. I'm going to talk to Armin Shimerman. I'm going to ask him a question I've had in my head for 20 years about, like, you know, who directs the character? Is it like, do you work with the writers? Do you talk? Like, do you? Because, like, it was clear that they did something based on his performance. And so, and then the guy in the Star Trek uniform gets up there and asks the same fucking question. And I'm like, well, I'll just sit right back down now, won't I?
Well, the difference between that is that, I mean, he must have been fairly intelligent.
He was British. I thought that was funny.
That's a question of craft.
Yeah.
More than, you know, what did the warp drive run on? So, I mean, and those are the questions I always ask. How did you come up with that idea? Did anybody argue with you about it? And did you regret it halfway through filming and you thought that was a bad idea? How did you change it? And it just so happens to be in a medium that I really enjoy, which is Star Trek. But that's different than, like, I need more of this in my life. And this is why Star Wars doesn't work for me, because I like Star Wars, but it's not the Star War itself that I find fascinating. You know, and the problem is that all that stuff where the process of making Star Wars isn't interesting beyond the first two, because the people who make it aren't very good. Like, listening to Irvin Kershner talk about making Empire Strikes Back was fascinating because he's a fun guy, or was. And it was like, here's the problems we had, and we were making it up as we went, and things like that. And then when you hear George Lucas sat down, didn't know what he was doing, and wrote The Phantom Menace on a legal pad, like, there's nothing to talk about. And the material isn't enough. So, you know, I can't get as invested in that as I can for Star Trek.
Yeah, it's not as deep.
Right. Which is why I find Discovery impossible to watch. And it's not very good, but the process of making it seems to be based solely on money and the need for spectacle. I don't need spectacle. I got Avengers movies for that, man.
Yeah, we have a lot of that going on, guys. Stop trying to compete.
You know, but a lot of fans like that stuff. Yeah. So.
Well, if any of you guys listening to this happen to have seen this documentary as well, you should definitely tweet us. What was I going to say? We are at the number 3 Drinks In Pod on Twitter. We are the same thing on Instagram. You can find us on Facebook. You can email us at 3drinksinpodcast@gmail.com. Let us know what you thought. We are available on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, Overcast, and Radio Public. Click subscribe, tell your friends, leave a review. And to that one jackass that left us a 1-star review, you can suck it or something.
We'll try harder.
We're working on it, everybody. You know, we promise the audio quality will be better next week. You know?
Yeah. Hey, we don't do any dumb gags.
No.
Boing. Yeah. You go to work in this medium, you got to stay fresh.
Can you say long lost triplets? Poochie. All right. Anything else about this?
I think that's it.
Yeah. All right, guys. As always, please drink responsibly, and we will talk to you all next time.
Yep. Take care.
Bye.